I know we don't.
Okay.
The Economic Development Budget Division for Wednesday, March 19th will come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but Senator Scoia, I think we'll hear your bill, and then once we have a quorum, we'll probably lay it over for inclusion, possible inclusion in the Economic Development Omnibus Bill. But I think it's kind of non-controversial. So Senator Scoia, Senate File 3603.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your consideration. Senate File 3603 is a bill that deals with Upper Red Lake. And a number of years ago, when Red Lake fishing was closed completely, we had a small little business loan program for the businesses that were so negatively impacted by that closing of the fishery. And we were going to ask those businesses to start repaying that loan when the fishery recovered. Red Lake is still a special regulation lake. They have a 2-bag limit. I think people have pretty well agreed that the fishing season is not restored to what we had expected when we passed this bill back in 98 or 90. Yes, it was. And so I have a small change to this, being more definitive to what recovered means. I have talked to Commissioner McElroy, and the department at worst is neutral, at best is supportive of this change. I do have a small amendment, an oral amendment, that I need to have offered on page 1, line 19, where it says a bag limit of 6 fish. I've talked to Senator Chaudhry, and he thinks that it would be a better words to use a regular statewide limit as opposed to the 6 fish bag limit.
I didn't get that.
Senator Scoia, repeat that, because we were trying to find your bill here for a second.
Okay. On line 19,
okay,
it says a bag limit of 6 fish.
Okay.
It should say a regular statewide limit. So we would delete bag limit of 6 fish and insert regular statewide limit.
Okay. When we get a quorum, we will act on that, okay? Does anybody have any questions of Senator Scoia? I think this is pretty straightforward, so. That's it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoia, is that include the 6 fish or just a statewide bag limit? I don't know that there is one that's standard for all the lakes.
Mr. Chair and members, the issue that Senator Chaudhry brought up was if the current kind of statewide bag limit of 6 fish is reduced to 4 fish, he had a concern about this language. And so what he thought is, other than the special regulation lakes, they currently have the 6 fish limits, and that he wanted to make that kind of consistent if they change that. I don't know exactly what, but those are the words that Senator Chaudhry had asked me to put in, and I've.
So in other words, what you're saying is if we should change to 4, you're fine with that?
Yes. Well, if this would deal with that,
right,
using these words as opposed to having the definitive 6 in there.
But I think Mr. Jensen's point is that some lakes have different limits than just 6. Isn't that it?
But Mr. Chair, and I believe that those are the special regulation lakes, which is Red Lake is one, and are separated out from the statewide limit because they're special regulation lakes.
So isn't this dealing with Red Lake, though? So don't you want your own language for it?
I think the way this reads is that the fishing on Upper Red Lake would recover to the point that it had a regular statewide limit.
Ah, okay. Okay. All right. You're excused.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I will track back with Senator Chaudhry and make sure that that language works.
Okay, we'll, as soon as we get a quorum here, we'll act on this, okay? Thank you, Senator Scoia. Senator Jungbar, we got the same situation with you, except we have to move yours to taxes. Is that the...
Yes, that is.
If we like it?
Well, of course you'll like my bill.
Escrow to Finance.
It's good to see that we have so many members here present currently. All going in several different directions, so it's hard to get us all together now, I know.
Senator Jungbauer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 3692 is just a clarification on a bill we passed last year on a mobile home or a manufactured home relocation trust fund that we created. We created it in the event a park closes to protect the homeowners on their relocation costs and things. We've had some issues as to who should collect. The department's been collecting the $12 fee. We do have, I guess, some issues in the way the bill's actually drafted in order to have counties do it, but that is, again, in the, something that will have to be taken up in taxes. Everybody's agreed that whatever fine-tuning we do in terms of that, we will try to fine-tune that in taxes. So really what we're doing here is we're taking it out of the collection out of the jurisdiction of the department and putting it at the county level and keeping the trust fund in one spot. And I have a couple testifiers to be short, sweet, and clarify how we're proposing to.
Who wants to go first? Please say your name for the record before you start your testimony, okay?
My name is Margaret Kaplan, and I'm with All Parks Alliance for Change.
Okay, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Kaplan, and I'm the staff attorney with All Parks Alliance for Change. We're an organization dedicated to the rights of manufactured homeowners in the state of Minnesota. Last year, the state took a really giant step forward by creating the Minnesota Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund. Working together with the industry group and the homeowners, we jointly supported legislation that was intended to ensure that all manufactured homeowners were protected in the event of a park closure. The way this worked is that it would be a self-funding fund where both park owners in the event of a park closure and individual homeowners on an annual basis would contribute to the fund. And the way that those individual homeowner contributions were put into the fund was basically through a $12 fee that would be collected by the park owners, sent to the Department of Finance, who would then send it to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency.
Is there any money left?
There is money in the fund, yes.
Even after all that?
Even after all that process, which is pretty large. However, once the legislation went into effect, it became clear that the trust fund collection method was both very confusing and costly. The MHFA's annual report to the legislature indicates that only 43% of the park owners in the state sent in reporting information and payments to the state of Minnesota. And of the homeowners in the parks that did report, only about half made the required payments. Now, on the one hand, we know that a couple of parks where the homeowners were told by their park owners not to pay contributions to the fund, and on the other hand, there are many community owners who tried to collect the funds from homeowners but were unable to do so due to the distrust that some owners have toward their park owners. What all of this does is it leaves homeowners, communities, and the state of Minnesota in the lurch. On the one hand, homeowners who did not pay due to problems in the collection method and who face park closures would be entirely without relocation compensation. On the other hand, the tens of thousands of homeowners who did make the required contributions to the fund could be faced with trying to get relocation compensation out of a fund that doesn't have sufficient money in it. Manufactured homes are taxed through the property tax system, and this trust fund is intended to protect the value of this property, including the trust fund payments on the property tax statements, such as they do, for example, in Arizona, would ensure that each homeowner has the opportunity to pay the trust fund contributions and be protected in the event of a park closure. And I have with me Mary Ann, who lives in a community that had just such problems. So thank you.
Mary Ann, would you like to tell us your problems?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mary Ann Brumman. I'm on the board of the Skyline Village Mobile Home Park. I've lived in Skyline Village for 25 years. Skyline Village is a mobile home park located in Virgo Heights, and it's owned by a Chicago corporation that is not a member of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. We found out about the relocation trust fund a few months after our park was supposed to collect our payments. We, as the board, flyered our park in order to let everyone know that this $12 needed to be paid. We sent letters to the corporation and on-site managers. We got a few of the park residents to write checks. We gave our money to the managers with a copy of the law, gave them instructions and the address of the Department of Finance. We contacted our city, we contacted our legislatures, and the Minnesota Manufactured Home Association, and even took the park owners to court. To date, and this was last September, our checks have not been cashed, the park owner has not collected or sent in our payments, and we still feel we're unprotected. We would like to make our payments with our property taxes. We are all very concerned. We will get no compensation if our park closes. I urge you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Have the checks been cashed yet?
No.
Why aren't they cashing the checks?
They didn't know what to do with them. We checked with the office manager, and we're told they do not know what to do with the checks. So we got them, the information gathered up, gave them the phone number, gave them the address, and to date, they have not done it yet.
Okay, a quorum is present. Does this bill solve the problem then, with the, in your opinion?
I believe it would, because if it's on our property tax statements, it would be so much easier. People in our park are afraid. You know, when we flyered, it was like, well, what are they going to do with the $12? It's like, it has to go. And I believe that they, because it did not come from the managers, that they weren't sure about the whole process. So if it went on the tax statements, yes, I believe it would solve the situation.
You have one more witness, Senator Jungbauer.
Yes, Mark Bruner with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. And we did support the bill last year, and we do support the bill this year to make changes to the collection methodology. And just as an update on the situation that you described at Skyline Village, they are not a member of our association, but I did talk to their general counsel. They're a Chicago-based REIT that owns the property, and my understanding is that the manager is no longer there, the property manager that created the confusion, and that they do intend to send the payments in. I have no idea if they've made it or not, but you know, it does raise an interesting issue. One of the things we did as an association, as an industry, is committed to the legislature last year that we would contact the approximately 800 to 1,000 licensed manufactured home parks in the state, tell the owners that they need to collect the $12 fee. And the way it works is that these property owners are charged with notifying their residents or their customers, if you will, that they're required to give them $12 to go to the trust fund. And then the property owner essentially deposits the money, writes one check to the Minnesota Department of Finance. And, of course, there's no way to ensure that every property owner actually did make the effort to collect. But even in cases where they did, and there was a letter sent from the Minnesota Department of Finance explaining that this is a legitimate fee, you know, again, probably about half of the residents actually contributed. So what the bill does is put on the property tax statement of each of the manufactured homeowners that they are required to pay the $12 fee essentially as a part of their personal property taxes, which then would be remitted to the Department of Finance.
Okay.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I've been aware of this situation because of the Skyline Villages down in the district I represent, and it seems like they just don't care, the people out of Chicago. They're not making any improvements. They're not doing a thing down there. There's abandoned buildings. There's some that have burnt down that are still laying on the ground, not even cleaned up. And if this helps and that goes in the right direction, we're going to pass this thing. But I'm really keenly aware, and I think I've talked to you, Marianne, about this. And
yes, sir.
I know Representative Atkins and I have been visiting about it. And and George Strebel, the mayor. So I'm concerned about this, and if this helps get us on the right track, we're going to pass this thing. So I appreciate Mr. Jungmauer. Thanks for bringing it forward. Okay, it's just too bad I'm not an author yet, but I will be next month,
tomorrow. Okay. Senator Jungmauer, the way this will work is we're underneath the finance division, we have to refer it back to finance, and we'll recommend that it goes to taxes and as part of our motion. So, Senator Sparks.
One quick question. Have the counties weighed in at all? I think it's a good idea, too, but has the Association of Minnesota Counties signed off on this?
Senator Jungmauer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, we are in the process of working with counties. Counties are a little bit hesitant right now in allowing anything to kind of open the door to certifying something under the taxes. So we're trying to figure out if there's a way that we can put it on the statement without causing everybody else to want to get their deal on the taxes as well. So the counties have said they weren't going to testify today, that they thought behind the scenes we can probably come out with something that works.
Okay.
So that's what we're hopeful before it gets to taxes.
Does anybody else want to testify on this bill that's in this room? Okay, then Senator Metzen will move that Senate file number 3692 be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation that it go to taxes. Any further discussion? Any further comments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you, Senator Jungmauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Sharon, are you in the room?
Shide was.
I know. But
Shide is right there.
I know. Well, I'm going. There. This is Cap's fault, okay? Because he's recommending this, okay?
This one?
Huh? What is that one? Scoey's. Oh, yeah. And then Senator Sparks will move Senator Scoey's bill, Senate file number 3006. Wait, first we have to amend it on line 1.19. We'll delete the words a bag limit of 6 fish and insert a regular statewide limit. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion is adopted. Then Senator Sparks will move that Senate file number 3603, as amended, be recommended to be laid over on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Economic Development Finance Bill. Perfect. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Senator Sharon, since you're at the table, you promised Mr. O'Rourke that this was going to be quick, I believe.
Nothing more than about 30 minutes.
No.
Senator Scheid, would you like to? Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Chair. I'm here with Senate File 3140, which is the boiler operators bill. And I need your guidance, Senator. We have a couple of amendments that I think that you have, so I cannot offer them myself. One is the A4 amendment. This is an amendment that aligns the language of the bill to the language that's been introduced in the House. Second is the A5 amendment, some modifications to the bill that have been worked out between the stakeholders since our last hearing.
Senator Sharon, this happened to me in a committee once too. We don't have the right version of the bill, so I'm going to have to ask you to wait a few seconds and bring Senator Scheid up here now. Okay. Because for some reason we don't have the right bill here, so the amendments aren't lining up with the right engrossment.
So, Mr. Chair, is that Cap's fault too?
That's Cap's
okay.
fault.
Just checking.
Well, for two.
I gotta kick you guys
that's
off
okay,
the table.
Thank
bring
you.
Up Senator,
happy
bring
to come
up Senator
back
Scheid
and,
now. We probably need to give Cap a raise so he can perform a little bit better. But anyway.
Appreciate it. Cap's been doing a great job. Cap's been doing a great job for us.
That's okay.
Mr. Chairman, do you have the second? Excuse me.
I suppose I better find out if I got the right one for you now. Huh?
Yes.
Is this the right bill?
3-29-26.
No.
30.
Having a bad day.
Maybe your last one.
Do you have any?
I think that's we need the first engrossment.
You've got the right one. That's it. Gotcha.
What about Senator Box? Is that?
We don't have him.
Oh, my God. Dude.
Now we get.
Do we have Shides?
It's a well-oiled machine.
We're on the second engrossment for Shide. Do you have the second engrossment, Senator Shide?
Yes, I do.
We don't.
Oh, no. Does she have any amendments?
I have an idea. Do we have my bill? My mess with the only bill, the right one?
Mr. Chair, it'll only be an issue if she has amendments, right?
Do you have amendments, Senator?
We can still work.
Chairman, I do have three amendments, and I'm just going to be right across the hall, so you can
go ahead.
Just don't leave without me.
No, we'll get this done. Okay. This is the first time I've kicked two authors off the table, so this is kind of fun.
It's not their fault.
It's not their fault, huh? We do have mine.
Bully, bully.
Make sure the next guy doesn't have any.
Senator Metz, if you want to
have
an
yeah. Then it doesn't matter if we have any bill or not.
Is this your bill?
This is, yeah.
That was very convenient. That yours is the only one we have the right version of.
I got really good stuff. What's the number of the bill?
3,300.
33.
Next.
3,300.
Bill under consideration is Senator Tomasoni's bill, Senate file 3,300. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate file 3,300 is the bill for the appropriation and the criteria for the health study for mesothelioma, which is the lung disease that we are dealing with on the Iron Range. And the part of it that's in this actual committee is the appropriation. As you know, we've appropriated $4.9 million from the Workers' Compensation Special Fund, which appears to be the right place for this because that's a fund that can deal with injured workers and workers who have had problems on the job. So this appears to be exactly the right spot. Not going to go into too much detail on this because I think we've all heard a lot about this, but I'll let the University of Minnesota go ahead and tell us why we need to do this and how important this is because, as you all know, we've had reports of 58 deaths from this disease, and it's one of these diseases that takes anywhere from 15 to 30 years to manifest itself, and we've got to get a handle on what's happening and how we protect the workers who start working mines in the very near future. So,
okay, we have Mr. Finnegan, is it? First,
yes, thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Finnegan. I'm Dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. I am joined by Dr. Jeffrey Mandel, also at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health Division of Environmental Health Sciences, who is the principal investigator on the study. The bill that is before you is meant to appropriate the full cost of the research that needs to be done in order to get to the bottom of the mesothelioma issue. Covers the four studies that we have proposed. I think staff have detail regarding that. We can go into detail on any of this as you choose. But we feel that we have the best chance probably in the last 25 years to be able to get to the bottom of these issues. And to that end, are seeking the $4.9 million to cover the cost of that research from 2008 through no later than 2013, with annual reports back to the legislature as needed.
Okay, very good. Mr. Mandel, did you have to some words?
Yes, I'm Jeff Mandel. I'm one of the faculty members in the School of Public Health, and I've been coordinating the different components of this project. Just briefly, the proposal that we've positioned is one that includes three worker health studies and two exposure assessment projects. The exposure assessment information will feed into the worker health studies, and that will enable us to get an understanding of whether work-related exposures to dust in the workplace are related to these mesothelioma cases. In a nutshell, that's what we're proposing to do. I can give you more details on the specific studies if you like, but again, in essence, what we're trying to do is to correlate the exposures in the workplace with these mesothelioma diseases and other diseases at the same time, so we get kind of a comprehensive evaluation of workers in this industry.
At first blush, it looks like quite a bit of money, but it's a five-year study, so it's not a, you know, so it's going to take time, and yeah, it's a big region up there too. I mean, it's a huge area that we have to look at.
Yeah, members of the committee, this has been posed as a question previously, and the reason for the costs turn out to be related to the amount of labor that goes into these types of studies. We've identified already about 75,000 workers in this industry, and each of those workers has to have a detailed employment history. We need to obtain exposure information on each of those individuals, and then we need to know what their health status is. So that's just information that takes a long time to collect, but it's really the only way to systematically assess the problem. It has to be done in this sort of way so that we can determine whether these mesothelioma cases or whether other cases are related to asbestos that's naturally occurring asbestos, or whether it's related to the commercial use of asbestos, or perhaps to other factors that include dusts, the various mining dusts will also be assessed in this process. So that's the reason why it's so costly. It's labor intensive.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank these gentlemen for undertaking this task, because this is a really big job. But it's one of those things that we've had two or three different studies at different times that were incomplete, and we never really got good information out of them that was accurate. And I think when the university gets done with this study, we'll know at least what we need to know in regards to the mesothelioma and if there's something that can be done about it. So I'm very appreciative of the University of Minnesota coming out and for us. So,
well, if we could somehow save some additional illnesses and deaths and things going forward, can't really put a price tag on that either.
That's exactly right.
We got to find out what's causing this stuff. I think.
Mr. Chairman, we have representatives from the steelworkers that are here. I don't know if they want to testify or not, but it's up to you if you don't want to.
I don't know. They could goof up your bill. You're doing pretty well now.
So stay
there. I know those guys. Ain't they? Want to take your chances with them?
Any more comments?
Any further comments from...
I just simply say, Chair, members of the committee, that we are doing this in close collaboration with investigators and scientists at the Minnesota Department of Health, too. And this has been a very good partnership between us and the health department and all the stakeholders on the Iron Range as well.
So, Mr. Chairman...
And this is a... There's several accounts. There isn't under the workers' comp special funds, and, I mean, we can... It's not an additional burden on the general fund or anything, is it, Senator Thomas? So it comes out of existing funds?
Mr. Chairman, that's the reason we did it that way, because we're looking at the budget cutting right now, and this doesn't cause any problems with the general fund. And there's a surplus in this workers' comp special account, and so it appears to be the right place for it, in addition to the fact that it's this is about injured workers, and so.
Well, you did your homework, I think, pretty well to find the right spot to take it out of. But anybody in the audience opposed to this legislation? Oh no, you're not opposed to this. Sit down. I'm just kidding. You're more than welcome to state your views. Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and my apologies. The legislation is not what the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce...
Oh, state your name.
Oh, I apologize. Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Mr. Okay. Chair. It's the policy in the legislation is not what we're opposed to. It's the actual appropriating money from the Workers' Comp Special Compensation Fund that the Chamber opposes. It is not only because when you take money out of the Special Comp Fund, it could trigger an increase eventually in the work comp assessment that employers pay, but also we're just concerned about the precedent this could possibly set. And so with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Well, doesn't seem like that's a good enough reason for me to change my opinion on this, but that's one member's opinion. Senator Koch.
Chair, Senator Tomasoni, you said there's a surplus in the work comp special fund. What's the balance of that fund at this point, or what is its surplus?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, I believe it's in the $25 million range. Mr. Jensen can give you the
Senator Koch, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, we've looked at this fund over the next 3 years, and there'll still be a balance after the end of fiscal year 11. So, obviously we don't know what's going to happen in the next 3 years, but it looks like it would be sufficient money to easily cover this in the next 3 years.
Okay, any further comments? Where does the bill go, Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 300 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation to go to higher ed.
Okay, on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. What do we got? Bot? Have you got any of those other ones figured out yet?
But now, you see, there's two bills that we can't do because there's proper.
Yeah. I don't know. Is Senator Bach's bill, I think, is in shape, isn't it? What do we need?
Senator Mock.
Oh, we don't have any.
So,
all right, we got a little.
Still waiting on those.
Yep. Senator Sharon's here.
Yeah, has that been
We're
fixed up yet? Explain it or something?
Talking about it.
Sure.
You don't make deads. There's no way to hear
that.
Tried to cut the cheese the guy off. No, I don't think.
That's wrong too.
I guess we usually just get them as
What do you sign your bill?
What's back?
What?
You did Bob's bill.
Well, we don't have the right one apparently. Which one? Which bill do we have, Cap?
I've got the Scheid bill.
Senator Scheid is across the hall.
All right.
Do we have the Sharon bill? Because she's here.
I don't have one.
Well, are you close to getting it?
I don't have one. Lit up duty, so I got the big one.
Okay, well, why don't you just hang around? We'll get, as long as Senator Sharon's here, let's wait for her bill. Her bill will be here in a couple seconds, right? Okay, so let's try and get Senator Sharon then, as long as she's here. Why don't you start and explain it, and have your witnesses, and then once we get the right language, we'll put the amendments on that you need to have put on. Okay. Okay, Senator Sharon, Senate File 3140.
Thank you, Chair. Tomasoni, do you want me to wait to describe the amendments and simply give you a little background on the bill right now?
If you need to describe the amendments to tell us what the bill is going to do, go ahead and do that, and so that we know what we're going to be dealing with at the time we actually want to.
Okay, I'll give you a little background on
and
it.
And I want you to think about one thing. Do you want this to move out of this committee and go on its own, or do you want it to be in the omnibus bill?
I'd like to have it go to the floor.
Okay.
Alrighty. Let me just give you a little background. If you haven't been in some of the committees that this has been through, because it was through business, industry, and jobs, and then went to state and local government, and is here because there's a licensing fee. That's what brings it in front of this committee. And it's a boiler operator's license. It's a reorganization of the boiler operator's license that emerged after this past year when an employee in Mankato started to notice that there were some concerns in the industry about their ability to hire a certain class of licensed boiler operators. So we had a summit in Mankato. At that summit, we pulled together the educational institutions that do some of the training programs. We pulled in the industries, many industries, and representatives of unions that we identified that had an interest in this particular license. And at that summit, it became clear that there was a short-term need to be resolved that was not going to be sustained if we could make some longer-term changes in the boiler operator's process and licensing. So as a result of that meeting, we had the Department of Labor and Industry, and Joel Amato from that department is here to answer questions for you. We've asked him to convene a stakeholders group. They met and worked through all of the issues that we could think of in order to resolve some of the industry's concerns, but also recognize the importance of sustaining safety and the interests of the license holders themselves. So the bill that's in front of you is the outcome of that group's work. And what it does is, we don't have the bill yet, is that correct?
Well, we have the old bill.
I think you can get the gist of it. The language changes are, I think, would become clear to you to understand what it is that the amendments are doing. But Section 1 of the bill reduces the minimum age for farm traction engine and stationary or portable show boilers and engine license from 18 to 16 years. But it increases the operating experience from 25 to 50 years and also indicates that it has to be, some of that experience has to be under full load, and 16 of those 50 years can be educational experience. The second section is the provisional license section. This allows an employee of a boiler plant to operate boilers greater than 500 horsepower, which is a change from the old statutes, 300 to 500. But that temporary license can only be used at that plant if certain conditions are met. And those conditions are that the license cannot be renewed, so it's limited. It can be revoked. The conditions of the license include that the applicant have a lower grade license, that the ratio at the place of employment is one licensed individual to provisional licensee, and that the employer has a training testing program for provisional licensees. The intent of this particular section is that the new provisional license is to create a process for grooming individuals towards a higher class license. And then Section 3 deals with something that the subcommittee wasn't able to quite get through. They were working on it. So it authorizes the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to establish by rules continuing education requirements and also clarifies that an applicant can only take a license examination once a year. And then Section 4, which brings it in front of this committee, sets a $50 fee for a provisional license. So that's the essence of the bill. Now, there are a couple of amendments. One of the amendments that's in front of you is the A4 amendment, and that's an amendment that changes language to accommodate to the changes that were made in the House.
Okay, Senator Sharon, we now have the second engrossment in front of us. Does everybody have a copy of the second engrossment so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the changes on the A4 amendment, is anybody disagreeing with these, or is there any controversy to these the A4 amendment?
We have that.
If there are any questions,
Mr. Motto, do you have? Are you related to the Chisholm models? Are you related to the Chisholm models?
Yes.
You are?
Yes, Bob was my uncle.
So you're related to Pozzo too, then?
Who?
Pozzo Valentini.
Yes.
Yeah. So then You're related to the Amatos in Chicago, too, then?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you have
to. I'm not going to admit to that one. I think
no, you are.
You are. So
you know.
What about them?
Well, they're in Chicago. Anyway. Okay, so the A4 amendment puts this into the shape that you want it to be in, essentially. Is that correct?
Well, I'll need your help procedurally. I've already this is the third committee, so I don't. This is language that aligns, that changes the language of our second engrossment to fit with the House's language.
Okay. Okay. Any questions on this, Senator Dibble?
Does it fit?
Yeah.
Work?
I did.
Okay. All right. Senator Sparks moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion's adopted. You have one more amendment?
Yes, we do. The 1444 amendment.
1444.
1,444 amendments. Imagine that. This is some language change to the bill.
Hang on. Do we have this amendment?
Yes, right.
Okay.
Has it been distributed?
Coming.
Okay, Senator Sharon.
The language change here, I think I'll, if, are you, come, would you be sort of going through some changes?
I could.
You know, these changes, I guess.
Thank you.
These changes are some kind of language changes, but what it really does is change the submission of the application process for the temporary licenses so that the chief engineer is in charge of the boiler plant submission for the application rather than having a sign-off. That's if you check the language against the original bill, the essential change is that the chief engineer is in charge of the process of application. And then the other than the commas and changing some of the language under 1.17, the language change there is related to setting a limitation on the provisional license for use in facilities that are owned or operated by a public utility cooperative electric association. This limitation is primarily in place because they have a process in place already, an agreement process in place already for dealing with gradual improvements of people through the licensing process.
Okay. Is everybody comfortable with this amendment?
Yep.
Anybody?
Uncomfortable.
Anybody want to comment on it?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubler.
First, Senator Sharon asked us to do an amendment to make it the same as the House, and now we're being asked to do one to make it different than the House. What's the long-range plan here?
Senator Sharon.
In the end, it's one of these bills in the short time that is molding and shifting and changing and improving. In the end, what my goal is a substantially improved product.
Trust me.
So this is a trust me amendment? Rakowski, you're okay with this? Everybody's okay with this. Okay. All right, then Senator Sparks moves the A08 amendment.
No, that one.
Yeah, it's the 08.
The 1444.
The 08 to 1444 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. Any further comments or questions on this bill? Anybody in the audience want to add their two cents here, or do anybody at the table here want to comment?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Bill Berger. I own and operate a small company called B&B & Associates, primarily for education and training. I'm also on the Boiler Advisory Committee, and I also am a retired member of Operating Engineers and represent the business manager of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 70. And I'd like to say that we support this bill.
And all the amendments and everything?
Yep.
Okay. And does anybody else, do you want to comment, sir?
I'm just here to answer questions. My name is Reed Sprung.
Chairman.
Sprung Services. 50 boilers, something like that. The company's wrong. with Minnesota licensed law, so I deal with this stuff all the time.
Okay. Senator Metzen.
I think this is a bill that I know Senator Sherrod's been working on quite a bit, and everybody seems to be online now. So I'll move the bill.
She wants it to go out by itself.
She wants it to go to the floor, I guess.
Okay. Senator Kubley, did you have a comment? Okay. All right. Senator Kubley moves that Senate file.
Hey, I made the motion.
Oh, sorry, Senator.
What kind of stink it is?
Sorry, ethanol.
I didn't hear you say that. But anyway, okay, Senate file.
Wait, you're on my committee, too.
Senate file 3140, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance, and then from there they'll send it to the floor, okay? So all those in favor, before I do that, any other comments or questions on this bill?
No.
Okay, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you,
Thank
Senator Sherrod.
Thank you very much.
Get it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't either.
Kubley.
Who we have left? No, we have.
Good.
Okay, Senator Scheid, somebody go grab Senator Scheid.
Do we get a new
or
Bach
Senator
bill?
Bach, either one.
Do we need a new Bach bill?
We do. Yeah, we do. So this way, at least you can see.
Is the Bach bill the right bill?
Which bill do we have? And that's why I didn't get the Scheid. Okay.
Let's get the Scheid one over here. Yeah.
Hey, Max, you got to come to the floor.
What, did they call for us?
Yeah.
Why did he pick on you instead of me? I'm trying to move this.
I'm also representing the operating engineers. You just want me to put that on?
You know what? Was that what you were in that? No, not by him, because I help him all the time.
Sorry, that's okay.
You see how fast I move this floor and comment it properly? But I'm not hurt.
Well, your name's on the That's it. Your name's in the minutes.
Senator Bach has arrived.
Senator Bach, and you both came at the same time.
Arm wrestle.
Are you? In, yeah, she's up. Yeah.
Did they call for us?
Yeah, you got to go, Mets.
Okay, Senator Scheid, we have your bill now, the right one.
Mr. Chairman, the second engrossment.
The second engrossment,
2926.
Yes.
Still warm.
And do you have amendments that you want to put on the bill first?
Chairman, I do. Well, I don't know if you want to do that. We had the bill in Senator Metzen's committee, if you recall, Mr. Joachim testified, and we did some amending there. I could do that. Let me tell you what the bill is, and then if that's all right.
Madam Chair, or Madam Chair, see, I'm used to calling you Madam Chair
right.
When I was in your committee, and I'm still wondering what that was all about, but anyway.
You are?
Yeah. So go ahead. Why don't you describe? You just proceed the way you want to proceed.
Okay. Here. Well, okay. Mr. Chairman and members, the primary purpose of this bill in the first instance was to correct technical and grammatical errors that were in our legislation of 2007 last year when we did construction code and licensing, a construction code and licensing bill. And that was a long and painful process, and I suspect if you had that in here, I'm guessing you had to have.
Yes, we're very familiar with it.
And we are here because of fee issues. That's why we're or fee matters that are in this this legislation. But there are three amendments. I believe one, I don't know if it's from the reviser. I think it maybe is a reviser's kind of thing. It's not, it looks substantive, but I think it's from something that was passed last year and not, that ended up being excluded. And that would be the AO8-1448. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rakowski tells me it has to do with independent contractor language. But it's something that was done last year, I believe.
Mr. Rakowski, what is the effect of deleting that section reference there?
Mr. Chairman, after this bill passed last year, this phrase that's being lined out as defined in Section 326.83 was actually amended, I believe, by you yourself on the Senate floor as a request from Representative Mary Liz Holberg, and I forget who the other senator was who was requesting that some clarification be put in to
that.
Make sure. I'm sure.
Go ahead.
I don't remember it. I don't expect you to, Mr. Chairman. But all we're doing is, rather than just saying as defined in Section 326.83, we're spelling out that landscapers, tree trimmers, and folks of that those kind of occupations are not defined as residential contractors. And so, therefore, they wouldn't be subject to the independent contractor language that we passed last year, which I know you're familiar with now this year because of the legislative auditors.
And basically speaking, so by taking out that reference to the section, you're just saying exactly what that section was.
Yeah, we're expanding on that, exactly. Amplifying it, if I may say so.
Okay. Is there anybody who has any problems with this amendment? Okay. Senator Sparks moves that amendment number 808-1448. Be recommended to pass. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. You have another amendment?
The A6, Mr. A6 Chairman.
Amendment.
Cool. Yes. This has to do with plumber's apprentice and.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association.
Welcome, Mr. Crimmins.
Thank you, sir. Last year in the bill, the apprentice, plumber apprentice, journeyman plumber, and master plumber definition was repealed. It was supposed to be removed to a different section and then repealed, and it just got repealed. It didn't get moved, so the definitions. They thought the computer would pick that up, but the computer didn't. So this is just putting those three definitions back into the language.
Well, Senator Saxhog then moves the SCS 2926A6 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, Senator Dibble.
So I'm sorry, this just deals with plumber's apprentice. That's all we're dealing with, not the other
Mr.
two.
Crimmins.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, yes, that's the only definition that it got the, instead of moved and then repealed, it just got repealed.
Oh, okay, but the others are intact. Okay, good. Okay, I didn't hear that right. Thank you.
So Mr. Chairman, if I might, I mean, last year's bill was a lot of recodification and moving around of things as well as some substantive changes, so that did happen. It's
okay,
a massive
great,
bill.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Saxhog renews his motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. We have one more, Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, yes, the A7.
This is really a friendly committee.
Subject about which I know very little.
I'm not moving this one.
Although I just have to share with you
Senator
that
Matson.
My neighbor, who is a plumber, installed
a
toilet in my house last night with an electric seat.
Wow. And,
so it's warm?
Fancy.
Yes.
Huh? Is it dangerous?
I'm worried about that.
Mr. Crimmins, maybe we need
I'm
an electrician.
I'm not
here.
Touching that.
Mr. electrician. On sort of the subject anyway.
Mr. Crimmins, I think you know about this amendment too. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and the committee members, last year we had a statute requested to be inserted that would ban a urinal that did not have at least 1 gallon of water flush. Salespeople were going around the state, and they were selling waterless urinals that are expressly prohibited by the plumbing code. And we wanted to get their attention. This statute did get the industry's attention. Now the manufacturers, the contractors, the Department of Labor and Industry, and the plumbers have gotten together, sat at a table, and we'd like to add some language that when the plumbing board
can change the rules at the plumbing code that expressly prohibit a water journal, then this section of the statute would be repealed.
The B paragraph right ahead of that, above it.
This is kind of an interesting amendment, isn't it?
It is.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble?
I don't know if I can support this amendment. There was a caucus called at my Senate district convention that had waterless toilets in the name of the caucus. It was like Franken or Cerisi.
I've heard everything.
I don't know how many people are, if they elected any delegates. Maybe there's a couple delegates going to the state convention that are all about.
Mr. Chairman, in our meeting with the Department of Labor and Industry, they did mention that this is something that has happened before. That once a rule has been amended, then the statute becomes.
It expires.
The statute has no reason to be there anymore, so then they just expire. And I believe we met with Tom Joachim and Randy Ellingbow in the plumbing division, and I thought it was Tom Joachim, as the building official, stated that the department has done this in the past. I don't know if Mr. Rakowski could speak to that. Or
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. Maybe Mr. Jensen would know. When it says that a paragraph expires, do both paragraph B and C stay, or does it go away? Well, I was asking Mr. Jensen. I just wondered. I'd never seen it before.
Do you know, apparently?
Well, I think it'll stay on the books until we make more technical changes. But it will expire. It'll be obsolete, but it'll still be on the books until we make more technical changes.
Well, how about this question, then? Who amends the plumbing code?
That's
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Crimmins can tell you who makes decisions about the plumbing code.
The last year in the bill, the Board of Plumbing was formed, and they have power to look at the codes and to make changes. If there's a 2/3 vote by the elected board, then they would make rule changes to the plumbing code in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Scheidt, how do we change statute?
Well,
by relying on someone else to make a rule change.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the bill last year was the result of a reorganization order by the governor, I want to say from 2 years ago. And it brought these trades. The Board of Electricity, I think, was it an admin? It was just by itself.
It was a standalone.
Just a standalone. I think plumbing was with the Department of Health. These trades were and professions were all over the map. And so they were brought into the Department of Labor and Industry, which makes sense. And then, as I said, there was this bill last year that had a lot of recodification. But the boards operated differently. As you might imagine, they were in different places. And now they're in one place, and I know the commissioner wanted everything to kind of work the same way, but there were advisory councils and that sort of thing that had been in operation, and they wanted to. So I think it's fair to say that the department worked really well with labor representatives of the trades in working out how they would be regulated henceforth. And in this case, is it the plumbing board? The plumbing board now is responsible in that legislation for
rules.
Establishing the code and the rules that go with the code. And so I guess you could say we've already given them the authority to do that. So this isn't giving them any new authority. It's just saying that on this particular case of waterless urinals or ones with a gallon or less flushing device, when they make a decision on that, then paragraph B, which precludes them being able to have those or to allow the use of those, would go away.
Carolyn?
I was thinking if we could change on line 1.10, we could change the when to an if. Paragraph B expires if the plumbing code is amended. instead of a when, which presupposes that it will be changed, which you are saying it will, but...
That makes a little more sense to me.
You know, I'm wondering myself if this is actually the best language, because it's, they may do something to address it, but they may not allow it. I mean, I don't know that. We're kind of drawing a conclusion here about what they will decide, and I don't know that we want to do that. So,
I mean, I understand the intent. I'm just trying to figure out how we say that if a, I mean, have we ever done this where we change a rule and then the rule applies to the statute and then the statute is then not, no. Have we, Senator Dibble?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can think of, we've allowed for, I think we have allowed for like provisional policies that fill in a gap until either another statute goes into effect or another body takes an action. Most recently, we enacted the authority. I don't know if this is a direct parallel, but you know, on the sales tax in the metro area, we said it expires if the counties don't enact the tax by October 1st. That's relying on someone else to do something, and then the statute is no longer operational. Even if it is on the books, it's no longer operational if the counties in the metro area don't enact the quarter cent sales tax.
Mr. Jensen?
Mr. Chairman, members, from time to time in each bill, we have instructions to the revisor to update rules, statutes, and regulations. In the Senator Scheid's bill, it's on page 43. It's section 49, some instructions to the revisor for renumbering all of the statutes and the rules.
And what page is? Are you on the second engrossment?
Yes, page 43 of the second engrossment. And they do, well, maybe it isn't.
I have section 56. What section did you say it is?
49 in this bill.
I have section 49. It must be on page 39. Nope, that's not it.
Mr. Chair, it is page 47, starting section 57, starting at line 47.12.
Revisor's instruction. Thank you.
Okay, Well, I'm fine with putting this in the bill. I'm just not sure how it works when it comes to changing the law. And I get what the intent is. But so if you want to do it, do you want to put if instead of when?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's, yeah.
Okay.
And I guess it does make sense that if, because the plumbing board is charged with establishing the plumbing code, but in the bill last year, I think this comes from that language, we did put in our own piece of the code, if you will. And I don't know if we did other elements of the code or not, but this one is one where they are talking about this, and they may decide in the future that it's workable. And so this language then says that, this language allows that to happen.
Do we need a better word than to address? Do we know what that
means? Chairman,
they
have the authority to do the code. So if they reach an agreement and the plumbing board decides to put it in the code, it's going to be fine in the code. It wouldn't need to be in statute anymore. Is that? I think that's how it goes.
Senator Dibble?
So it was your question, Mr. Chair. I don't know anything about these. I don't know if they're a really, really bad idea or they're the next best thing. But is your thought that they're really bad and we should to prohibit or?
No. I think that subdivision B is what we have right now. So there's probably somebody who wants these waterless urinals to be able to be used, and somebody probably doesn't. And so the plumbing board that is now consolidated with everything that Senator Scheid has talked about earlier is probably going to be discussing this and figure out what the solution to it is. But I don't know what the word to address waterless urinals and urinals would mean. So I'm just wondering if it would be to allow, to change, to what?
To regulate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, even if they agreed
to regulate maybe would be a good word.
Even if they prohibited them, it wouldn't be needed because it would then be in the code. we wouldn't need the statute. I think that that's right. And I, by the way, I mean, the Board of Plumbing is not, it's consolidated under the Department of Labor and Industry, but it's not intertwined with the other boards here in making this decision. Okay, I'm sorry.
I misstated that. Mr. Kermans, are you comfortable with that language to address?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. All right. Then Senator Scheid incorporates in her amendment the word if instead of when on line 110. And Senator Dibble, you move the A7 amendment?
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I got these constituents
the
here.
Election.
I think Gary Thaden called that sub-caucus.
You better not. Senator Saxhawk moves the A7 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. All right. Is there anything else we should know, Senator Scheid? Where are the fees, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, I think Mr. Chairman might want to see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Schultz is here from the department to help. Are you?
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the fees that are in the bill relate to manufactured home fees, and they, for the most part, are moving from rule to statute. So there's minimal impact in that regard.
On page 40, members.
And I'm not so sure that I have the same line numbers that you have, but there is the one that established a replacement construction seal fee of $30, and that's necessary when the seal on these manufactured homes is removed or lost. It could be when they're besiding the structure or the like. This is just to establish that fee for the replacement of that construction seal. There's also an installation seal fee where there's currently two at $8, and it combines them into one at $80. One previously was for installation, one was for anchoring. This combines them into a single fee that covers the cost of the seal and related activity. One of the other changes just simply clarifies that there's a federal HUD label fee. Just clarifies that that is paid to HUD and not to the department. And also, it does. There's some changes that are related to the license terms, and those are really intended to correlate with federal license terms, as well as neighboring states that the department may have reciprocal agreements with, so they're consistent, so that Minnesota doesn't have annual fees that are different than what the triannual fees are and license terms are for the other license types.
Okay. Any questions or comments? Are these? I think you said the installation seal fees. That's an increase, right?
There is an increase there.
And are all increases or?
No, I believe that's the only other one. The other ones are moving from rule to statute.
Okay.
To as they're required to be in statute.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Bruner is here from the manufactured.
Mr.
Home.
Bruner.
I'm Mr. Chairman Mark Bruner, Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. We have worked with the department over the summer on the language and the fee increases, and are supportive of why it's necessary to do that.
Okay. Does anybody else need to comment on this? Okay. All right. Anything else, Senator Scheid?
Chairman, I can't think of anything else. No. Thank you for doing the three amendments. And
even though they were out of the purview of this committee, we're just being really nice to you, just so you know. This could easily be our vehicle, just so you know.
Mr. Chairman, this has been a long road for the folks in the department and the boards and... it's been a work in progress, and I think that, you know, I'm not going to say they've covered every possible thing that might have been missed, but we're getting there.
Well, and you were on the conference committee last year, Senator Scheid, and you know what there was. It was pretty involved legislation, and there was a real lot of people cooperating to get it done and to get it done right. And I think like these technical changes that didn't get fixed the first time, or supposedly we got it right this time, and I imagine we even have instructions to the reviser in case we screwed it up this time to fix them. So, so I think this should work. So, Senator Sparks moves that Senate file 2926 as amended be laid over on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Economic Development Bill. Any further discussion or comments from anybody? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. Thank you,
thank
Senator
you for Schein. Your indulgence.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, that's Senator Bach. Good.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
Thank
you.
Nobody's up there.
We should have the first engrossment, everybody. Senator Bach, do you have the first engrossment?
Yes.
Okay. We've had a couple of glitches here today, so.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, Senate File 3271 is a tax credit proposal for business expansion in the state. What it does is it defines a Minnesota small business investment company, allows deed to certify those companies. Those companies then can make investments in businesses in Minnesota, and later in the future, starting in 2013, after the money has been invested for a number of years, they would be eligible for tax credit 20% of their investment per year, up to receiving 80% of their investment in the business back. I have with me some people that have some experience in this in other states. This is modeled after a proposal that's in effect in a number of states, and they can better explain its success than I can. But, Mr. Chairman, the cap on the bill. Drop your jaws, but the cap on the bill is an $80 million tax credit phased in over 4 years. So there'd be $100 million invested in Minnesota businesses, of which over a four-year period of time, starting in 2013, $80 million of it would be rebated or be used to offset future tax liability.
Mr. Cassidy, would you like to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard. I'm here today to speak to Senate File 3271 in support of it. Here with me today is Mr. Michael Korngold with Enhanced Capital Partners, which is an investment firm that's worked on this project or these projects in numerous other states. The economic development tool you're about to discuss is that we're under consideration today has a proven track record in many states, including New York, Texas, Missouri, and Wisconsin. It's also an economic development tool that comes at a time when our economic conditions are causing credit markets to tighten and capital is becoming very scarce for a number of Minnesota small businesses wishing to expand and take that next step. This proposal is fairly straightforward, if not quite simple. The Minnesota Business Investment Act will channel $100 million to growing Minnesota businesses so that they can expand their operations and grow jobs in the state. To accomplish this, the Minnesota Small Business Investment Act would have the Department of Economic Development license and regulate investment managers, such as Mr. Korngold's company, to go out and pool the resources of insurance companies, into a $100 million investment pool. The investment managers would then invest those funds in local growing Minnesota businesses who may be having a difficult time finding financing from traditional sources, such as their local banker. There are a number of businesses out there that are visiting their local banker these days, and their pro forma at the time of their growth cycle just isn't quite fitting the business model that the bank or the pro forma that the banks may be operating under. Investment managers would be required by this proposal to target investments in small to medium-sized Minnesota businesses, businesses with less than 100 employees that have the majority of their operations based in Minnesota. In exchange for the insurer providing the initial capital, as Senator Bach alluded to, the insurer would receive a tax credit against their premium tax obligation in the state of Minnesota. That tax credit would not kick in until 5 years from now in 2013, but only after all the funding has been raised, $100 million, and certain other criteria and thresholds have been met, which are spelled out in the bill. The tax credits paid out over 4 years beginning in 2013 in $20 million increments until the year 2016. The tax credits may be forfeited under the bill if investment managers do not invest the funds in qualified investments in a timely manner. And investment managers are not allowed to take any profits from the fund until 100% of their investment fund has been invested in targeted qualified Minnesota businesses. This program has a proven track record in other states and has been improved upon over the years. We feel we've made a number of changes in the bill to reflect some of the history that the companies have experienced in other states. Texas recently reauthorized this very same program for another $200 million in tax credits after the success of an initial $200 million certified capital tax credit campaign that was initiated in 2004. New York has now authorized the program 5 times. With that, I have Mr. Korngold with me today as well to elaborate further on some of the points that I've made and to speak to the bill and also to elaborate a little bit further on the role of deed, which is obviously why we're in this committee today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Cassidy. Mr. Korngold, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Say your name for the record and then go ahead and tell us about the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Korngold. I'm the president of Enhanced Capital Partners. We have participated in 12 of these programs. Actually, our 12th should close today in 6 different states. A number of these states, as Mr. Cassidy mentioned, have done this program repeatedly after they've seen the initial successes of their first foray. And I'm a native Minnesotan, and I've told others that, you know, as I've watched this program adopted in a number of states, I've always thought that in many ways this program would be perfect for Minnesota because there's such a great business culture here. There's a great history here of entrepreneurship. There's great banking history here, but there's a real capital gap. And if you look at businesses throughout the state, not just in the Twin Cities, businesses with good ideas and good plans for expansion hit a wall where they may need $500,000, they may need $1 million. That's not enough to attract a typical venture capitalist to look at them if they've got an equity-type company. And if they're not bankable, they can't get a loan for that money. That's the capital gap that this program fills. And unfortunately, the history of those companies is that many of them either don't expand, shut down, and in many cases, they'll go to where the capital is because the capital demands that. The reason that the states that have adopted this program have chosen to reauthorize subsequent programs is because they can demonstrate very clearly that the benefits of the investment in these businesses, the job creation, more than offsets the eventual tax credits that the insurance company investors get years down the road. The last thing I would say, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, is that Mr. Cassidy alluded to some changes that we made in this bill, and one of them is that we put the largest delay before the tax credits would actually become available to investors of any program that's out there. Typically, there's a 2 or 3 year delay to allow the economic development benefits of the investment to take hold. In this case, as Mr. Cassidy said, the first tax credit wouldn't be available until 2013, and then incrementally over 4 years.
And Mr. Cassidy or Mr. Korngold, how do they become eligible for the tax credit? I think it's pretty neat that we're getting insurance companies to loan money to us with no guarantee that they're going to get it back. But but anyway, the tax credit, does it have something to do with the amount of jobs they generate or how the business performs or how does that exactly work?
No, the tax credit is generated when firms like mine, and in a program like this, there would be anywhere from 6, 8, a dozen firms that would come to apply to be licensed for this program. We would then, it's just a free market process where we would go out and try to raise funds from insurance companies, and they get the tax credits when we have invested that money into the qualifying businesses, into the businesses located in the state. And in this program, 25% of that capital has to go to the Iron Range, Greater Minnesota, or low-income communities. If we don't satisfy those requirements, they don't get their tax credits. If we do, then they do. So when they make their investment, we show them the compliance mechanics, that we have in place to ensure that we're going to do that.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I was just one quick technical question. What is it says a low-income community as defined by some section of federal statute. What is that?
It's a low-income community reference that's been used in a number of federal, similar federal-type programs, one of which you may have heard of is the Federal New Markets Investment Program. What it means is that 20% of that census tract is below the poverty line, or more than 80%, less than 80% is above the statewide median income. And it's an internal revenue code. I can get you the full reference.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. So, okay, that makes sense. If you could give me more detail, that would be great. A question, Mr. Chair, to Senator Bach. Senator Bach, you know, we recall some of the criticisms of Job C that we saw in the auditor's report. You know, around, you know, can we quantify job creation? You know, targeting this effort towards strengthening sectors of our economy, that sort of thing. Do we envision that at some point we'll have an opportunity to review, take a look at the success of, you know, the success in terms that I think we have yet to define, in terms of jobs and economic activity and we're net attracting and creating new jobs for, that sort of thing. Do you envision that we'll have an opportunity to assess and evaluate at some point along the way? Is that in the bill?
Who wants this? Mr. Korngold?
Okay, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill provides for a mandated annual report, an audit that's paid for by the participating fund manager, and in addition, a report that has to go back to the legislature detailing every investment that's been made, the jobs that were there at the time of investment, the jobs that are there today, and everything that's happened in between. The program has been exhaustively studied in other states, so I understand the transparency may be an issue, but one of the hallmarks of this program is its function in other states, I think, is the transparency.
Senator Dibble.
Can you point me to that language in the
sure.
proposal?
It's, it would be subdivision 6, which begins Minnesota Small Business Investment Reporting Requirements.
What page?
Page 10 of mine.
Page 10.
Great. Thanks. Okay, thank you. I'll read through that.
Okay. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand this, now the insurance companies are making the loan to the business, and then they qualify for the tax credit, assuming it goes to a qualified business. And then, so the money should theoretically come back to who? To the insurance company or?
Mr. Korngold or Senator Bach, who wants this?
It offsets future tax liability that belongs to the insurance company.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, so if it offsets it, but it is a loan to the company, to a business somewhere?
Mr. Korngold.
If I could answer that, the insurance company makes either an equity investment or a loan, depending on the deal that's cut, to a fund manager. And a number of insurance companies, no one insurance company can control a fund, and there are those requirements in here as well. So a number of insurance companies will pool their capital with a fund manager. And that fund manager's job is to go out and find the small businesses in the state that qualify and make those investments. Those can be in the form of either a loan or an equity investment. And then the returns go to three places. One, the insurance company, obviously, that was the original source of the capital. Two, the reason that fund managers want to participate in this program is after all the money has been invested, they're taking, hopefully they've done a good job, and they're taking profits and a profits interest. And then there's also a provision in the bill that channels a portion of those distributions to support the university's incubator program and the rural angel network that exists here.
So, Mr. Chair, so they get the insurance company gets could get the money back and the credit, or the funds managers that invested in the company, if they do an equity investment, then they theoretically there's nothing to pay back. Do the in the company that they're investing in, is that
the company repays? You know, hopefully they've made wise and the fund managers made wise investments, and that money flows back. The insurance company wouldn't make this investment simply for the tax credit because they're if they make $1 million investment, they're making that $1 million investment up front. So they're now out $1 million. And they're going to get 20 cents a year in the form of a tax credit starting in 2013. So on a kind of present value basis, you know, that in and of itself they would never do because if the present value is 40 cents of those tax credits, you know, they've given up $1 million for something worth $400,000. So they're expecting to get repaid not only that difference, but hopefully a return on that money that makes it worthwhile for them to do it. And it's one of the reasons why, frankly, many insurance companies that we go to and talk to them about this investment pass on it because it's too long-term and, frankly, the returns aren't good enough.
Which leads to one other question, if I could.
Senator Vandermeer.
In other states that have done this, if it isn't an equity, if it's a loan, what percent, I mean, are they typically all paid back, or is there a percentage of loss?
The
Korngold.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The loss rates have been comparatively low when you look at similar, like we're often compared against the federal SBIC, which is a program, which is an investment program. And the program loss rates are much better. But these are small, fragile businesses in many cases that are growing. And as everybody's aware, we're in a cycle right now where, for a variety of reasons, businesses don't succeed. And so, you know, that's one of the decision points that an insurance company is making as to whether they want to participate in this program.
Thank you.
There's, Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandermeer, there's risk in this. I mean, we're asking somebody to put up, pick a number, in aggregate, $100 million, and they have to be successful in loaning all that out. And then 5 years from now, we're going to give them a 20% tax credit each year for the next 4 years. So the time value of money thing is it's a real deal in that they have to wait 5 years before and have been successful in getting all the money loaned out before they're eligible to receive any tax credits back. People are taking some risk here because it could be if they're not successful in getting the money loaned out, they're not going to be eligible for the tax credits.
And then from our firm's participation standpoint, it would be a disaster for us because we can only get profits if we've successfully invested the entire fund. If we spent 10 years here with an office with two investment professionals working to find small businesses in the state, only to get to the end of the road and realize we've done such a poor job investing that there are no profits, that would be obviously a worst case scenario for a program participant.
The pretty neat part is that there's lots of people with skin in the game, and
right.
So there's going to be a lot of people trying to make this thing work right, and should result in good economic development in the state as well as tax revenues to make up for the credits, I would think.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the thought is that there is additional tax revenue coming in through the investments and through the new employment that more than offset the tax credits for the state. And it's a way for us to leverage some private investment and not have to put any money up front.
That would be true, provided it's not in an enterprise zone. Is there any restriction to this? That could be problematic, couldn't it? If you,
I think, Mr. Chairman, I heard that the House got rid of Job Z in their tax bill.
Oh, well, that's not a problem.
So they saw the wisdom of the Senate. The Senate did that last year, so we'll have to see all those discussions go with the governor.
So, Senator Brock, I take it you want this in taxes.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman of the committee, $100 million is always drafted, and that's probably a little rich. you know, from a tax credit standpoint, I think we'll have a discussion in tax committee about maybe scaling it down some for our first run at it, and if it's something that works, maybe we'll be like many of the other states that have come back and reauthorized a second time around. But clearly we're not doing enough in job growth in the state, and we need to try some things. And if somebody's willing to put their capital at risk, you know, it seems like it potentially could be a win-win situation. And
Senator Dibble.
I appreciate having the opportunity to present the program.
Want to move it?
Sure. I'll move it at the appropriate time. I just had a quick question or suggestion. Thanks for pointing me to the reporting piece. I'm just wondering, Senator Bach, if it does talk a lot about the number of jobs, number of employees. I'm wondering if we would also want to know about the nature or the quality, you know, some more context about those jobs. Just a thought. I'll have another crack at it in taxes, though. So,
you know, Mr. Chairman, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, we want to create livable wage jobs, and that might be a good thing to work on between now and then, that we set some kind of thresholds like we have under the Minnesota Investment Fund. I think they're 100%. The jobs have to be 110% of the poverty rate, I think would probably be a reasonable thing to plug in. So we'll spend some time working on that between now and taxes.
Great.
And Senator Bach.
Oh,
go ahead, Senator.
Oh, it's going to move.
No, go ahead. Are you just going to move it?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Bach, Mr. Jensen points out something you might want to take care of in the tax committee. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, there's application fees in here, and there's fines in here, and there's going to be interest income. Is it clear in here that the commissioner has authority to set up those funds and those accounts? Quickly reading it, I did not see that. I'm just asking that question to make it workable is all.
And you can deal with that. We don't have to deal with that.
Jensen, thank you. We'll do some research on that and find out. We don't want to go to all this effort and find out that deed never actually certifies anybody. Because deed does have to certify the investment companies. So.
Okay, so.
And Mr. Chairman, again, they have to set up those accounts in the state treasury.
To receive the fees, correct.
Or it has to go someplace that should say where it goes.
The fees themselves. Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, obviously, those fees would be collected by the commissioner of deed. And are you suggesting, are you addressing the issue of the funds being collected from insurers to create the pool, investment pool, or are you talking about the fees being collected to certify the investment managers?
I'm suggesting where do the fees go that the commissioner collects?
Okay.
Does he have accounts? Does he have funds set up?
We will.
Just to make it workable.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we'll address that with Dee before the next hearing. Thank you.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? All right. Then Senator Dibble moves that Senate file number 3271 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it go to taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you very much. Members, our next meeting will be next Wednesday, a week from today. We will probably be rolling out an omnibus bill that should deal with whatever kind of budget deficit this committee has been assigned to take care of. And then there will be a few of these bills that we've been dealing with and some policy stuff in the bill that then we'll send to finance, and probably Friday morning that thing will go up on the floor. So that's the plan right now. Hopefully it works. Meeting adjourned. Have a happy Easter, too.